Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining the High Tech and Report Work Group. I'm Wendy Noboa with OMC, and I'm pleased to welcome our co-chair, Aaron Meary. Also joining us today are our work group members, Han Bottendyke, Hannah Galvin, and Eliel Oliveira. Unfortunately, Madel Briggs-Melanson is not able to join us today. We are expecting Jim Georges and Anna McCollister to join shortly, but in the meantime, just a reminder, public comments are welcomed and can be typed in the Zoom chat or made verbally during public comment. And now I'll turn it over to Aaron for opening remarks.
All right. December 18th, just a few days before the holiday festivities. So hopefully you are all in the final swing of things and getting ready for it. We got a full agenda today. So I look forward to chatting and talking about all things as we wrap up this annual report work group for this term. It's just like a joy to close the year strong. It's my final meeting, so it's really sort of bittersweet for me, but I look forward to talking to you all. We can put a bow on this as a present and move on for next year. So as you see here for our agenda today, we're going to talk about our sort of the schedules as we're wrapping up for the year. Really what we want to focus on today, one of the most important things is really try to put a pin in the illustrative stories. I hope you all saw the note from Michelle and team earlier in the week. And hey, Anna, we see you. Thank you for being here. And we really want to look at those stories and make sure that it makes sense. As a reminder, those stories, illustrative stories, are to try to put into plain English what all of the various nuances of items that we are recommending, what people could expect, right? What would that look like in the real world if all of these things were able to come together? So stories are very important at sort of cascading down what we envision as the net positives for the industry. We're going to go through, talk about the draft supplemental background research document. We really want to look at that and make sure it makes sense. Is there any glaring omissions? Remember, at this point, it's probably too late to do any serious modifications or edits. Doesn't mean that it can't go into the backlog, but we really want to talk about that document and make sure that we're on the same page. We'll go to public comment and then next steps and adjourn. Next slide. Okay, next slide, please. All right, we're here, December 18th. Very, very close to the very end. The annual report will go to the High Tech for approval in January 31st, and then February, March timeframe be transmitted. It is always an exciting moment when this is voted on, and I hope you all enjoy that fruit of your labor there. I will appreciate the ONC team, Michelle, your team, Excel, everybody. It is something every year to behold that document, and it truly becomes a work product of love from this committee. And the High Tech takes a lot of pride in it. So for the new members on this group, enjoy the moment when it's approved and voted on. Next slide. Okay, so draft report, so January 18th, and then of course the approval will happen February 8th thereafter. Next slide. All right. So next steps for development of the High Tech report, we're going to review the draft and report today in supplemental background, and then of course present that for full approval and discussion at the upcoming High Tech meetings. I will say there will be a lot of new members joining this year, obviously with a lot of committee members rolling off. So it's incumbent on you all to tell the story and tell the story of why the annual report matters. There'll be a lot of new faces voting for the very first time on something that they just joined the committee on. So it's very, very important to make sure folks understand the veracity of the document, to understand the depth of knowledge, and understand the importance of each of the topics, and help the new folks also feel contributory towards the next session, right? So that when the FY24 annual report is put together, they give their inputs. As we've always said, and it's very important, every single opinion on the High Tech matters. It doesn't matter how far-fetched the idea is, it matters. It matters to be heard, it matters to be respected, and it matters to be engaged in a way that people want to be engaged. Next slide. All right, let's go. I think next slide should be the supplemental background. It should be the stories, right? Okay, here we go, outline. All right, outline, of course, the report. You guys have seen this before. We get the report as you look at it, sort of an orientation slide here. You get the landscape, which has the illustrative stories, which we're going to talk about here in a minute. The health IT infrastructure gaps, opportunities, recommendations. That's what we spent the majority of the year really talking about. There's a good progress report there on the high-tech progress. What have we worked on? Like a ton of things. You know, HTI-1, TEFCA, all these things that we did this past year. Conclusions right at the end. And then the appendix with some benchmarks, acknowledgements, et cetera, et cetera. It's also, you know, I would say really neat to look at that section four there, the progress, especially for the new members, help them orient on what we've done so they can jump right into the fray. Several of them will be, as you all were when you first joined HITECH, kind of trying to feel the waters. Where do I be? Use the report as a way to get folks engaged quickly on the topics, especially with HTI-2 and others right around the corner, especially with USCDI cancer and others, you know, starting up. There's some great initiatives that they can get involved with, and the report is a way to galvanize that support. Next slide. All right, draft illustrative stories for FY23. So again, I hope you all took a look at the note the other day. We're going to look at the initial set of options here for those brief illustrative stories, and then what we hope the HITECH will be able to help enable and foster for the future. The final report, a single illustrative story will be highlighted as a paragraph in a call-out box for each of the target areas. So each target area, like cybersecurity or public health, each of them have an illustrative story, which hopefully you help contribute towards. Hannah, I really appreciate your some of your red line edits. I saw the draft. It was excellent. I appreciate your feedback there and precision around that. And then again, we want us to look at the stories, suggest additional ideas, anything in there, tweak them, help spelling if there's issues, although Michelle's team does an amazing job with grammar and, you know, anything else. But anything you see, this is our chance to really, really call that out. Next slide. All right. So let's go through them, right? So first target area, use technologies to promote and advance health equity, right? I don't want to read this back to you, but a lot of the items in the red, I think, Hannah, there's a lot of it's your edits here. Take a look at this, right? I don't want to read it to you. And Eliel, I know you're driving, so please don't read and drive at the same time. That could be dangerous for your health, my friend. But for others on the call, take a look at this. Let's take a minute here. Right, I can read it out loud if that's helpful, but I don't want to put you to sleep. Hannah, you want to talk about your edits? Maybe that'll be helpful for the group. And you're on mute. You're on mute.
I'm still on mute.
There you are. Now you're good.
Okay, cool. I was trying to pull up my version of my edits because I think I had put some information in comments as well that just had contextual information about it. But I think that that overall I thought that there may be some confusion about sort of what we were the diabetes management coach was asking about. And so that's where I put that edit in. Here we go. Just so that I have my comments to reference here. And very specifically, yeah. Right. So I think that my first comment is that we said, due to new SDOH standards and the development of the framework to support implementation, it said the physician's patient can query records. Well, we have some of that today. So we may want to clarify what we meant by SDOH standards. And then write that we have this in the chart in a structured way so that it can trigger a CDS tool, right? Previously, we may have been able to see some of this data, but now we can have it in a structured way that triggers a CDS tool, because it's not brand new that we can access some information, but having it in a structured way enables the use then of semantic interoperability. So that, I think that was my main comment here.
Other comments about it? Eliel, thought?
So we're talking about the first one, Aaron? Sorry.
Yes. Yep, yeah. First one. Yep.
Yeah, I think what I had, Aaron, yeah, is related to after the red sentence that says the physician regularly follows up on the progress made. And usually what we've seen is that community health workers are the ones that are doing that work, not physicians necessarily. And I think that given now that CMS and others are reimbursing for community health workers, that might be an important, you know, terminology of staff or individuals that are deeply involved in the coordination of social services to be introduced here.
So what if we said practitioner versus physician? That way it could be sort of whomever is associated with the patient, right? Is that a fair word maybe we could use versus physician?
Yeah, you could do that, and you could put in parentheses, you know, physicians, social workers, healthcare, community healthcare workers, you know, to make that broad, as you're saying.
Yeah, because I mean, I think the goal of this statement, the way I read it, I think it was a great suggestion, and I see your hand raised. I think the suggestion was around the standards, especially coming up with USCDI, being able to exchange the data more freely, it's more available, and people can use it whatever the course of care is. Whomever the provider may be, or practitioner rather, and that's the more word being used these days. So I see your point, Eliel. Anna?
I guess I was just reading, I skipped ahead to the second one, so maybe I should hold my thoughts until then.
If you don't mind, yeah, so just so we can put a pin on the first one, then we go to the second bullet here. Second, yeah, no, it's great. Hold the thought. Other ideas around the first, number one. Hans, I don't know if you're able to read it.
I am, but I have a question about number two after Anna.
Guys are eager to jump on. Okay. So I think we're all in agreement then for number one, just so we get Michelle's stuff straight here. For number one, again, make it a little more broader to practitioner, in parentheses, of multiple types of provider, et cetera. So folks get that sense that basically it's about the SDOH data being available to be used. It can be used appropriately, especially for folks in the food desert, which we have here in Jacksonville, and it's very sad. Okay, let's go to number two, right? An older patient with worsening vision needs to see a specialist. All right, so I think, Anna, you had your hand raised first, and we'll go to Hans. Yeah.
Sure, one question that I had is, part of, you know, when I look at this as somebody who has diabetes and vision issues. There are tools that are available now that use iPhone technology to actually do retinal scans. I think it was the first, honestly, I think it was the first, a version of this was one of the first AI tools approved by FDA a couple of years ago. So I'm just wondering if it would make sense for us to incorporating that into telehealth, or is that taking us outside of the realm as a way of like pulling in the various data sources and tools that the US government has the ability to encourage implementation of. Since ONC is ostensibly the gatherer of all things related to this, or is that completely outside of the scope of what it is we're trying to do?
No, it's a fair point, right? So we're trying to paint the picture of what the art of the possible is, and what we can materialize if we were to get various dimensions addressed that HITECH is recommending, right? So if there is some incorporation of leveraging tools like artificial intelligence in the future, because now this data is available, right? SDOH data and can be leveraged. I don't think it hurts to incorporate that, especially given that, to your point, ONC is doing an excellent job of convening the AI componentry. So I think it's a very fair point, right? To even if it's just allude to the fact that it could be done, I think it's a fair point.
One of the biggest barriers with that, I mean, this gets into CMS, but one of the biggest barriers of that is, does CMS reimburse for it? And I have no idea if CMS is reimbursing for this kind of AI-enabled retinal scan using, you know, an iPhone. But it seemed like a way of filling out the picture, saying, in addition to having like broadband access or, you know, whatever, using these tools through this platform, there are other tools that other parts of the government are working on that are an essential part of this mix.
So even at the very end there, and say, you know, work with a specialist to devise a treatment plan, and perhaps leverage tools like artificial intelligence to look at the data and suggest a course of action, something to that effect, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
these are approved devices, so. Yeah.
Okay. That's a fair suggestion. Hans.
Yes, thank you. I have two questions that are relatively minor, just from a flow perspective. The first one is that the switching where the suggestion was made to change from a senior patient to an older adult, but then subsequent sentence talk about patients. So just what's the intent? Are we trying to keep it neutral and it's not necessarily patient? We may need to then use adult a little bit further in as well. So it just seemed to be that the switch was could be adjusted. The larger but still flow question is around the reference to SDOH data and the sequence that's in here. So it's clear from the first part is that somehow it's discovered and understood that the adult is in a area where telehealth broadband access is not readily available, but it's not clear from the way it's stated how SDOH data contribute to either the awareness or otherwise to that. So I think it could be adjusted a little bit to clarify that that's how we learned that the patient has a need there. And based on that and the community initiatives, once we had it established. So it's just a little bit of a flow question to understand why we're going from the voice to text technology, SDOH, and then suddenly the broadband arrived.
Got it. I got it. Okay. I see how you got there. Okay. Good suggestion. Good observations. Thank you for that. Any other comments on this one?
Is the main crux of this like putting like the government, doing this public-private partnership around establishing broadband access? Like, is that the main thrust of this one? It seems to me that it is, and if so, I think that's appropriate because, you know, there are places not far from where I grew up who have no broadband access.
Places here in Northern Florida that don't have broadband access, that are literally on an island, So
that's this is just point. Ohio.
I think it's important. I mean, Hannah, I know you added the private-public partnership componentry. You want to kind of go into your thoughts there, what you were thinking?
Well, I thought that, that it wasn't, the previous text there had said that with the help of the office administrator and some digital literacy education, and my comment had been the patient needs not only digital literacy education, but a means to access the internet. And we should highlight right elsewhere, right, we talk about that they need to access services enabled through some of the public-private partnerships we're talking about to enable access to broadband internet and a secure location. And that is something we are making recommendations about that we need to, that we are asking ONC to really help enable, right? There is some inequities in the digital landscape in general. And it's not just about literacy and training and education, but it is about actual access. So that's where I recommended that we put that in as well.
Got it. I think it's a great, I like the suggestion. I like the addition there. I think it's important to highlight it. Any dissension to that? I think it reads actually pretty good.
I think it's an important part of health equity.
It is. And a lot of work's being done there too. So it's a good call out for that.
Yeah.
All right. Michelle, anything else on this particular one that you're missing from us?
No, I'll just make a point in general around these that part of the exercise is to come back and then choose one. We picked one as a default to put in the report just so you can start reviewing, but we do need some input on that.
Okay, well, let's do that. So thank you for clarifying. So of the two, do we have a lean towards which one we would put a star beside as a 1A? I'll go first. I like the first one. That's me. Others?
You don't or you do?
I do. I like the first. I mean, I think they're both great, but I would go with the first one. But they're both good. Other thoughts?
Well, I think that they get at two different issues. I mean, again, maybe I'm now over-focusing on the broadband access, but I feel like that's an incredibly important health equity issue, particularly
for rural, whereas
the food insecurity, like, that's historically been the kinds of stuff that we that you think about when you think about social drivers of health. So do we have to pick one?
Well, we could always use one as a placeholder for next year, right? Just because we go with one this year, that could create the narrative for next year, I would think.
The reason I would go for one is because as I was reading the rest of the report, there was a good section talking about how digital access was a major factor impacting health. And also was talking about language, flexibility for individuals that need language support. So, meaning, I think that's well addressed elsewhere. So I do like the point here on the internet access, broadband access, because I know that's a major issue. But when I balance the two, yes, food insecurity comes to the top, like Anna was saying. And I think the other one is addressed elsewhere in the report.
Okay.
Is it?
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, is the broadband thing addressed elsewhere in the report?
I think so. Maybe it is on the special research document. I'm trying to search now to see.
That was a question from me, not that it wasn't a...
Yeah, maybe Michelle knows. I don't know. I don't recall off the top of my head. All right, we will get that answer.
It feels to me like the first one is kind of more of an urban issue and the second one is more of a rural issue. And I would not like for us to pick sides.
I'm reacting somewhat similar as Anna, is that there's a little bit of, identified two different drivers, and that helps indicate a little bit of the breadth and depth of what SDOH can get into. Don't only think about one kind, think about the other kinds as well. It all adds up to one way or another that might raise challenges. And actually, in that sense, these two help create a little bit of that spectrum of the variety that you can think about. That's why I have a hard time. If you twist my arm hard enough, I may end up with a choice, but until that time, I might not be able to.
So Hans, was that an answer to one of them, or are you saying you like both?
I like both.
You got to choose one, my friend.
Well, that's why I said, if you twist my arm hard enough, and it sounds like that you're starting to twist it hard enough.
Yes, sir.
In that case, I actually would be inclined to go for number two, but that's okay. Because I might have a little bit more of the technical to demonstrate that that technical issues can contribute to that. But that's as far as I can go, and that's not a strong argument. It's actually very weak in my mind.
Got it.
And again, I mean, part of my reason for like continuing to raise this is like, you know, urban versus rural has become a partisan thing, sadly. And I think it would be helpful if we could make it this read like it's a partisan thing.
We cannot have that partisanship show up in high tech. So confirmation, broadband is addressed in the crosswalk. It's, and they're reducing the digital divide section, the general section of that area, confirmed by ONC staff. So it is called out. Doesn't mean that one or the other. So it sounds like we've got two for two here. It's two for number one, two for number two. So Hannah, you're going to be tiebreaker.
So for number two, sorry, that was sort of the multitask. Number two is the. Can you remind me which is number one and number two?
So number one is the food desert item, and number two is the broadband access.
And which one are we?
It's split down the middle. So two. So Ellie and I both said number one. Hans and Anna said number two.
So you got a choice.
You got a choice, Anna. You got to choose.
I got a choice.
Choose.
You gotta decide which one we're gonna do.
Yeah.
I am going to go with broadband access.
Okay, broadband access it is.
Yeah.
So they're both amazing. So this is it's a good problem to have, and you have two of them. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then that will tie nicely then to that section that's also called out in the report. So we asked that question. Good. Michelle, does that help?
Yes, very helpful. Thank you.
Perfect. All right. Next slide. All right. Public health. Near and dear topic to everybody here. All right. The story here is not two to choose from. It's one to choose from here in this case. Sudden surge of gastrointestinal illness. Because of TEFCA, they're able to share data real-time, real-time syndromic surveillance, essentially. Within hours conducting a test, samples, we can find the contaminant, issue a bowl of water advisory neighborhood. This would be amazing. It's going to be pulled off. And then you want to speak to what you said, Hannah, here. The department reviewed the transportation and security data. You want to give a little comment on that?
Yeah. So I think the, where is this one? So the department reviewed its SDOH data to identify housing and transportation services that could be provided to community partners in a neighborhood. And I think I was wondering, what is the purpose of them identifying the housing and the transportation services, right? Are they just, are we using SDOH data to offer additional services just because we have the data? Or should we be a little bit more specific around how we would use the data specific to the use case? For instance, the department reviewed the transportation insecurity data in order to offer non-emergency transportation services to those affected who needed rehydration therapy at local center care centers, right? There's sort of a difference between saying, hey, we have this data, and so, hey, how can we use it? Or how can we use it in this particular crisis, right? In the long-term solution, it may make sense that they share the de-identified data map to help remove the source of contamination. But I think, you know, how are they addressing the short-term emergency with the long-term solution? And I got the sense from the wording that it was just very vague. And so I thought adding a little bit more specific color around it might be helpful.
Okay. Good thoughts there, Hannah. Thank you for doing that. Hans, you have your hand raised.
Yes, I have a question on the first part that it may come across that unless they had TEFCA, they were not going to be able to achieve this. And from the feeds that already are going into public health, it seemed like there's already data there that can be done today. So what is really the unique part that TEFCA brought to it that could not be done today? To identify the cluster at this point in time. So that's my concern. Are we putting something in there that for the intent of the storyline is not really that critical? It is the fact that the data that was shared and analyzed based on demographic data available was used to identify whether there was a cluster in a particular geographic area or a particular neighborhood, whatever it might be. So that's what I'm trying to understand, is that really that reference necessary, and is it overreaching for something that it did not really contribute much to? And I'm trying to figure out what it is.
I perceived it, and I believe this question will open for the group here. I know we have two hands raised here. I perceived it that because public health will be leveraging TEFCA, that for the agencies like in Austin, Texas, where they rely on fax machines, literally, and there's public stories about the fax machine being broken, and therefore COVID-19 tests couldn't come in, positive or negative, they now have an option, right? Versus today, there's no option besides fax machines. I read it with that mindset, that lens, from my personal experience of the craziness dealing with public health, because there was no other option for them. To your point, doesn't mean there's other ways to do it, right? There's many ways if they so choose to connect, direct connections to others. But I read it as a mechanism that now that TEFCA's up, it's an option for them that they maybe not have had before. That's how I interpreted it.
I understand that. I'm just looking at that today is that one of the key elements that was providing this kind of information, case reporting, was clearly in that vein of what did you have available to do that, but that was actually already expanded substantially without TEFCA in play yet. Sure. Through quality, health exchange, et cetera. So that's why that was my backdrop to say is that I'm trying to figure out what is TEFCA adding. Now, I can think of a lot of areas where TEFCA can enter, so don't get me wrong there, but for this particular use case, it struck me as not adding enough information or believing that it could not be done today. And it already can be done, actually is being done with the connections that are available.
Yeah, for the participatory folks, you're exactly right. All right, Eliel and Anna. Eliel.
Yeah, my comment was a little bit related to that as well, Aaron, but with a different twist that I think if this is supposed to be forward-looking, I think I would imagine that the reason traffic would be brought up here would be that we advance from the, you know, messaging exchange to a API-based trafficker, you know, which is still up and coming. And I think everybody heard very well in the annual meeting at the OMC annual meeting how, you know, CDC, ASHTO, and NNPHI released that opportunity for implementation centers that are going to exactly trying to get the public health organization authorities kind of into the, you know, Fire API exchange. And that to me would be a reason to change this a little bit, but then it gets too technical to say that that exchange of or the monitoring of surveillance would be done through APIs, where you basically, as an agency, you're just parsing that information. So that will be a different way to, and the reason for TAFCA here. But again, does that get too much in the weeds and to envision the future state?
Interesting. Anna?
Well, I guess my question as it relates to like TAFCA exchange and this case study is based on, I mean, like lab data is not yes and not yet as part of US CDI. So like the data that's being exchanged does not include lab values, and wouldn't you need to have lab values to be able to identify issues and exchange that information related to public health? So, I mean, are there, or is that sufficiently captured in ICD-10 codes? So for instance, if the issue was like a new lead poisoning, like, you know, in Flint, Michigan a few years ago, would that have shown up in the data that's currently present in ICD-10 codes, or would that need to show up in like lab values that show like the lead levels or, you know, some sort of like an E. coli contamination or like whatever is likely to get into the water system? This is more of a question, but based on the data that I've seen from my healthcare institution, like my data that's now available for exchange, theoretically, none of the things that I would think you would need to identify this would be included. So, I mean, I think it's fine if we're saying future case, we have lab values and that kind of stuff is being transmitted, but I'm not sure exactly what it is that we're saying in this. What is the point of this particular thing? Like, what's the thing that we're pushing for?
Yeah, no, it's a great point, which I bet you is what Hans has a hand raised about, because he just wrote something in the chat. Hans?
A little bit of that, and a combination on reacting to Anna's comments around USCDI. I like where Eliel was going, and the trigger for me to thought is that what is TAFCA in public health, and what is really being talked about right now, is that query for additional data. I can get from the patient, I can get that additional context that the initial reporting feed might not have included. So if we can put it in that context, and we can take any data that was missed, because data is not always included, then I think the TAFCA context will provide a little bit better. Hey, once I do that, I actually have a better data set. USCDI does not include certain lab data that might be helpful for this, but actually does not mean that it's not being exchanged. USCDI is substantially covering less data than what the standards and the actual reporting already allows or requires to report. So a lot of data is actually being reported that USCDI has not included yet. Since there has been a couple of different locations, HITECH has already discussed very widely as well. We have these electronic lab reporting standards. We have these LOI lab report standards already being used, already being deployed. Why not put them into USCDI? Because we already cover it. It's already there. So I think we have to always be careful that using USCDI to understand what is actually being exchanged, we have to be careful about it, because the standards in many cases are well ahead of the USCDI standard. Other cases, they're not. It's a combination of both.
And those standards are, it's like, so like the lab value exchange stuff, that's part of the TEFCA standards?
Well, that's interesting. They are not today, are not proposed, because TEFCA is focusing on a very targeted subset. But once you get to the document exchange, what is in CCDA documents particularly, but if you look at what is in what FHIR could get access to through queries, much more is already available there. If you look at what is already in certification programs for EHRs in particular, to be and certain lab systems to communicate to public health, that it's certainly there in for some of the key requirements there. Lab reporting, case reporting now moving forward, syndromic surveillance, vaccination, et cetera, they're already there. Some still to come.
So, Hannah, any comments from you?
I don't have any.
Okay. So it looks like we're all leaning towards Hans, your suggestion in there about focusing a little bit or adding into this paragraph the specificity of follow-up data queries and the ability to garner more, again, accuracy of the data, more of the data elements, because now the vehicle exists to do so. Not that you couldn't before, but it was not easily readily available. And now because of the TEFCA, getting that follow-up data is accessible, which seems to answer Anna's question about outbreaks and whatever else and following through on the data so you can do that Sherlock Holmes kind of detective work that's necessary with the right data at hand. That seems you were all leaning towards. Am I hearing that differently from anybody?
I'm just trying to understand how, given the data that's currently being exchanged, the public health department would be able to have enough bulk data to identify a signal for a public health outbreak.
And I think that's not there yet, right? But aren't we looking, we're looking forward thinking with these
that's
use
right.
cases.
Yeah,
that's
precise. Okay, cool. That's great.
Yeah, that's precisely if we were to implement all the various suggestions right in our document there, what would the ideal world look like? What does utopia look like?
Utopia.
right.
So that's a stretch, right?
I have a few other parameters for utopia, but.
Yeah. And I think that's why I broke it down between what can you do to help in the emergent situation today. Right, and review sort of their SDOH data and provide the transportation right now versus also then the public health, looking at the public health data. And do we want to mention both? Because they are sort of two different data use cases here.
Right, yeah. But all relying on follow-up data, all relying on accessibility of data, all relying on the accuracy and the ability to even exchange the data. So,
or data that was not sent before because it was not deemed relevant. Right. It's missing data maybe today that are not a complete picture and you want to follow up and say, oh, by the way, can you give this? But there's also data that until COVID hit, we want to now suddenly 3-6 months worth of data back because we were trying to figure out what was going on. That those are the kinds of follow-ups that we now, that TEFCA would allow for much more than just individual feeds that we do today. Individual feeds only gives you so much.
And with, I think the question about TEFCA and the public health data is how identifiable or de-identifiable is it? And I don't quite, or de-identified is it, right? I don't quite have an answer on that, right? If you were going to identify the source of the contamination, you would need to have some identifiable data there related to location or address.
Or the respective QHIN on the TEFCA would have to be able to get back to the root of where that came from and contact that health system or whatever
right.
and say, hey, help us query backwards the origin for contact tracing or whatever you're gonna do, right?
Yeah.
And currently the reportable results tests that just focusing on lab to the public health, I'm not aware of anyone that is de-identified. They're all identified that you can follow up. But the syndromic surveillance is de-identified based on what's happening. So it depends on what you're looking for. You'll have more or less identified and de-identified data already available.
Yeah. I would imagine a situation here. Let's say we're getting these gastrointestinal reports coming in through the ECR, right? And you're getting a sense, well, is there something going on here? But through API queries, you basically could ask, you know, a whole QHIM or network traffic and see how many of those cases are really taking place there without ever knowing the individual or the organization, but just in region and a zip code, say, this is how many kids are taking place there right now.
Right.
That becomes very effective, right? Very quick to pull.
And that's extremely hard to do today.
Right.
Kafka with the queries, it will become much easier to do that.
Not perfect. I think that's the point. That's the point. It is much easier to do. I think that's the whole synthesis of this paragraph, right? So, all right, are we all in agreement then? Again, sort of adding in that specificity of the ability of getting that follow-up data, sort of interweaving that, it's taking your quote there, Hans, but massaging it in Michelle speak to add it to this, to give this some more meat. Is everybody in agreement with that? Any dissent?
That works. Okay.
Michelle, is that clear for you?
Yes, I think we have enough information to do that.
Perfect. Okay. Next slide. Interoperability. All right. Two use cases. Again, we have to do the vote and select which one we want to double down on. So the first one, cardiology practice, query TEFCA to learn about the patient's previous diagnoses, et cetera, et cetera. Because of the technical framework, requires standardization, use of patient matching. The patient records are able to be matched through the TEFCA queue and acute in exchange. This is a very true thing. It's a mess today dealing with patients that go across state lines, but you know, you can do certain amounts of lookup today. This should be easier in theory with TEFCA. The second one here, we'll focus on the first one first. But any issues with the first one? All right, Hannah, you have your hand raised.
Yeah, so I think my comments here were mostly about how I still don't quite understand why the future state of QHIN to QHIN matching is going to be any better than our current state of patient matching. From what I read and Hans, maybe you or someone else can elucidate me and help me understand this, but I would like to, and I've been sort of asking this question, like, why is this going to be so much better? From what I read in the QHIN technical framework, the QHINs use their own matching principles, but they have to match on any demographic features that they have. So I personally would just like to understand this better.
Yeah, so whether it's RLS or others, right? So, okay, yeah. Hans, first up.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would agree with Hannah that some of the fundamentals are being addressed and not unique to TEFCA on the actual matching. And some of the work that's now being asked on the improving addresses in HTI-1 is going to help and advance in that part, which in combination with TEFCA is certainly going to help. The record location service is, on the other hand, that aspect of TEFCA is that we can have a better opportunity to find all the locations where the patient has data that is relevant for what I'm trying to do. So I think it may be more focusing on that aspect. It still requires good matching, otherwise I don't know that the patient has been there, but that's given that advancing regardless of TEFCA as we move forward, it's the record location in my mind that is giving us the opportunity to get access to a more complete record virtually. And if we can get good at that, very efficient at that, beyond what currently is happening, then that would be a big step forward because I can now tap into the better record. I think that's the promise of TEFCA.
Good points. Eliel?
Yeah, I'm almost going to be making the same points, Aaron. So instead of doing that, I feel like number two might be the best option here for these anyways. So.
Okay. You jumped right ahead to voting. All right. Let's talk about number two then as a group real quick before we go to the vote. All right, a SNF recently implemented an EHR system. A new EHR includes interoperability, et cetera, et cetera. SNF was able to see more patient information from the hospital records, which would be phenomenal. Through the EHR vendor, the SNF administrators also learned about TEFCA and created a plan to participate. That's beautiful, including benefits determination. That's an interesting add-on there, which should be very important for skilled nursing. Ideas about number two, thoughts, comments, questions.
I'm with Elio.
This one seems more straightforward.
It does seem more straightforward.
Very clear. Yeah. No confusion.
Okay. Hannah, thoughts?
Sorry, I was muted. I added the including benefits determination just because I thought that was
I like that.
I do too. I think it was a very astute ad. Anna, any thoughts?
I think the second, if we have to choose one, I think the second one is more straightforward, and I love that what Hannah added in terms of benefits determination.
Okay. Number two it is. That was easy. All right. Number two it is. Michelle, is that good?
Yes, perfect.
Perfect. All right. Next slide. Privacy and security, my favorite topic. All right. Patient received behavioral health care, received free training from nonprofit, about new data segmentation, DS4P. Based on this training and using open source consent management, the patient reviews a health record, chooses not to share the behavioral health data with certain other healthcare providers, also a medical emergency, which would be wonderful. I'm a big fan of granular choice. This is possible because of collaboration between providers, et cetera, and use cases. All right. Somewhat number one. LEL.
Yeah, I like this. Honestly, I just thought that maybe we could be a bit more specific on the behavioral healthcare provider, meaning I'll suggest here adding something like at our incarceration facility, you know, because that to me says, okay, I'm being discharged. I was, taken to jail. They had a clinical provider there that took care of me. I'm going to be discharged. I don't want my primary care provider to know that I was in jail. You know, that should be my option. But under certified EHI exchange, that could happen.
Right. Or a substance abuse treatment facility, right? Another example there. That's a common one I see often folks requesting the records to be suppressed or remove that data and other types of situations like that. So it's a good suggestion, Eliel. Interesting. Hannah.
We'll just say specifically around the incarceration piece, that shift is doing a lot of the work around standards in this area. We're specifically excluding incarceration related data in our first pass at this, only because that CPO data is often right now not captured in a structured format or used in certified EHR technology. And so I would just be cautious about mentioning it specifically, as I think it is, I think it's incredibly important, Ilya, just super, super important. But I think that we are multiple steps from being able to get to segmenting around data related to incarceration or data related to CBOs, steps away from that, and the ground layer has to be even just the structured certified EHR data. So my hope is that we get there quickly as well, but I see some additional barriers for that type of data.
Yeah, I think the point here, Hannah, is like, it doesn't have to be that case. I guess that's one that came to mind, but something that makes this a bit more specific. Why would somebody not want to allow that sharing, right? And I have seen so many cases here in a medical school where young females that don't want their parents to access their records, all kinds of situations. So I just thought that we needed to figure out what it would be. So since we're talking about behavioral health, what would be one behavioral health situation here that would make that person say, I don't want that to be shared?
Yeah, that's a good point. And if we're not going to add something more in about reproductive health, which is obviously a big hot topic right now, and if we want to skip under behavioral health, you know, we may want to say something about a behavioral health hospitalization or an involuntary hospitalization.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good one. That's right? A good one right there, Hannah. That's an interesting point.
Right. Yeah. That's a section, well, in Massachusetts, we call it section 12, but right. Yeah. Right. An involuntary hospitalization. Right. So I think those are, if we want to really keep it under behavioral health, obviously reproductive health is also a huge, huge.
It is. But the problem is right now, it could be too hot right now. The water temperature could be too hot.
To yeah, mention. Exactly. Exactly. So I think that's, it's why I say maybe keep it behavioral health. So yeah, I think, you know, if we keep it to involuntary hospitalization, that at least keeps it within the sort of certified EHR technology framework as opposed to going out to the jails.
Interesting suggestion. I like that suggestion. Yeah. Anna?
I guess I just have a question as to why are we changing mental to behavioral? Because I see those as two different things. And
I made that suggestion, Anna. My understanding is that that has become a cultural norm to refer to behavioral health care in that capacity as opposed to mental health care, which has been a little bit outdated, that terminology. And so that was my suggestion.
Okay. That's what we've done here. Yeah, that's what we've done in our health system too. We have a very large behavioral health program. We're very clear to say that because it's a multitude of factors, not just mental health. It's a multitude of factors that feed into it.
Not all mental health issues have behavioral components. I mean, so we don't need to adjudicate that here. I just didn't. Yeah, whatever.
It's a good observation. It's a very good observation. I'm glad you asked that. Hans.
I'd like to support number one. I think it's it can be very clear and it points to an ideal state. A couple of things that still have to be done, quite substantial, in order to be able to have consent management. So I think it's a good ideal state. What can we do if we address everything in our report? So wholeheartedly support. And I think it's more clear than we haven't talked about number two yet, but I'm going to do an allele here. Is that it really clarifies a little bit more and speaks to that to the challenges that are particularly live with identifiable data. And less so with de-identified data, because you can do already a lot more in that space.
Okay, so let's save some time here. Do we all agree with number one, by adding the component of involuntary hospitalization? So that gives that inpatient componentry to it. So a patient who was recently discharged, or recently involuntarily hospitalized, was discharged. Is everybody in agreement with number one being this choice?
I don't understand why we have to choose, because I see these as two incredibly important elements for privacy and security, and they're distinct. So
it's because of the way the report is laid out. We try to do one story for each illustrative section. So for each of the sections of the report. So I think it's just for brevity of the report. Otherwise, the report gets really long.
And to be honest, on the second one, it's a weak one, in my opinion, because de-identified data release, it's kind of already well-established. And we talked so much recently on how account of disclosures is so hard to do. And now we add in account of disclosure for de-identified data. It didn't make sense to me.
I read number two LEL as a health system as being very proactive and garnishing trust with the patients, which I think is phenomenally important, of simply telling them, like, hey, this is literally how we use your data, AKA syndromic surveillance, de-identified, right? Or something, you know, positive, so that folks truly understand beyond their consent of their data, really, what are you doing with my data? Identifiable or de-identifiable, right? AKA, are you selling it, right? Which a lot of vendors are being creepy with data these days. So that's how I read it, was just over the top. Truly, the data is yours, belongs to you as a patient. And the system is just a custodian, which is exactly what they are.
Yeah, I feel very strongly about both of these, quite frankly. But I mean, I've done a lot of work with, you know, in speaking as well as with clients to begin establishing like a transparency and impact reports for how de-identified data is used, because I think it's utterly important critical to the future of data access interoperability, because people are losing, they've lost trust in institutions to protect them. So I think most of the uses that come with data are generally beneficial, but if all you know is that you don't know anything about how your data is being used, it breeds mistrust. And I think it's appropriate mistrust. So that's why these are two qualitatively different things, looking at two different elements of, you know, privacy and security. So it's, I don't know why, again, I understand report format, et cetera, but do we?
We got to choose one. I hate it too, because I think they're both beautiful. They're both beautiful stories, but we got to
let them. Can we incorporate the data transparency into the first one then?
Can you combine?
You could perhaps on the first one say, and the data is subsequently being de-identified and used in, and then address aspects, but then you're really then taking two things that you have to explain.
Yeah.
Tend to share identifiable and awareness of its reuse in a de-identified form. To which, for certain data, you might at some point in time have some rights to not include it, but I'm not sure to what extent you can today.
Say something like they received a report, their de-identified data, of how their de-identified data was used, confirming that their choices were respected.
Hannah, you were about to say something?
I'm just trying to think through number two.
I mean, I'm pretty sure, I don't know the exact statute, and I will ask and find out, but the point is, I'm pretty sure that number two is actually a requirement, legal requirement. It's just the conclusion has been that nobody could figure out how to do it yet, but we've moved on since the last time. I think it was Aaron, you may remember this. I think it was the HIT Policy Committee checked this up. I know Devin and I had some discussions about this when we were working on the HTI1 stuff.
Mm-hmm. And I believe that the first is also a requirement. You have to be able to record and honor consent directives, but it's extremely hard to do, particularly when it becomes electronic and entire data classes and groups are being excluded to avoid that conundrum.
Well, number one is only the requirement so much as patients can request the restrictions, but the covered entity doesn't have to right now under HIPAA. For HIPAA covered entities.
But once it has been granted.
Once it has been granted, then I don't know if you guys saw, but there was language in the final rule saying, right, that in 2025 or 2026, there needs to be an internet-based way for patients to request the restrictions. And if they grant the restrictions, then you have to be able to honor them. So I think that is very clear, and it was made very clear in the final rule, the HTI1 rule. But yes, they don't have to grant the restriction right now under HIPAA. For the second one, I don't know how much this is actually being done right now, and I don't know what law and I don't know what law actually governs that this has to be done. And I think that would be very helpful if our ONC colleagues can maybe come back to us with that, because this is very hard to do, and it's very hard to do in a way that is helpful. And so I think understanding what our next steps are, like, I would love to do this, but I would want to understand sort of how we can do this in a helpful way. I don't think we talked about this. Yeah.
Eliel.
Yeah, I was thinking that there may be a good way to connect the two here, because it makes sense, right? So we're saying that the person is providing a consent, or in this case here, decline to consent to share data, and that case is identifiable data, right? And then you can also add a sentence or two here, basically saying that But in the case of de-identified, that the hospital, the health system is providing a report when they ever share. Because you're saying, I don't want my identifiable data to be shared about this specific situation. And if you share de-identified, I would like to know. So it would be part of that consent. It's a double-edged sword, I guess.
So we need to, Michelle, I'm correct. We need to choose one, correct?
We can think about ways to integrate them a little better. I don't know how far we can go, but I do like that idea.
Okay.
But if you want to choose, you can. You're still that option.
I'm just trying to make sure we help you guys the best we can here. So, all right. So then I think we're all agreeing. We're all agreeing these are both very important. And I think we're all agreeing that if there's a way to incorporate elements of number two and number one, that we do so. But we're leaning towards number one, but incorporating the key elements of number two into number one. Is that where I'm hearing final answer is? Because they're both.
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy to take a crack at combining them. That would be helpful.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Okay. Any objection to that?
Do I have the slides for this to be able to do that?
We sent out a Word document about a week ago that would have that in it, or you can make comments on the slide using a comment box.
Okay. Sorry, I'm really bad at homework.
No worries. Okay. All right, I think we're good on this section then. All right, next slide. I think we're at one more. I think that's one more. All right, endocrinologist looking at health apps, diabetes turns to the healthcare, to a new healthcare industry website. The doctor links several of these apps to the patient portal as resources. Doctor can then direct her diabetic patients to patient, the practice's patient portal, where the patient could choose from the embedded apps. Okay. So, Hannah, you want to talk about how your use of healthcare industry website, I'm just curious. Like when I read this, I was curious, like, why did you think that? Like, not that I'm disagreeing with you, I'm just curious, like, how'd that come to be?
So I think I said, right, so initially they said, an endocrinologist is looking for health apps, she turns to it, it said, she turns to a new website. So I don't know that I specifically said healthcare industry website, but my comment was, is ONC sponsoring this website? We should probably be clear that this is a government website or a professional society website, not just a random website. Are we saying that there is app certification, that this app certification is through ONC, right? So I think I just wanted to be clear that like, there's not just some website out there saying, you know, here's got like, Google has put together guidance for clinicians, but like, how are we, right? Is it an ONC sponsored website? Like, how are we envisioning this website? I guess I just wanted some detail around that. I don't think I specified the words healthcare industry, right? There are other organizations like the AMA that may come out with guidance and websites, but I think that was all just it, that it wouldn't just say new website because that could be anything that I just Google.
But in diabetes specifically, there's an entire community of white hat hackers that I'm part of I would think would do a way better job at vetting diabetes apps for security and privacy than what the American Diabetes Association or JDRF or AMA. So I don't know that I don't know what we get out of stipulating healthcare industry.
Interesting. Eliel.
Yeah, I think when I read this paragraph, the point that we are trying to make here is that there is some sort of body that's vetting these apps that are available for patients so that they are trustworthy and can be used, you know? And so if that's the point of the whole sentence or paragraph, you know, yes, having this industry website kind of becomes too loose now. I guess we kind of have to make a decision here that there is some agency, whether it's the government or not, that's actually validating this, kind of like what the FDA does for drugs, but somebody needs to validate these apps at some point and make sure that they are safe for patients to use. And then the doctors can look to link to their portal because they trust, you know, somebody's done their job.
Well, we need clarity for the FTC to rule on certain things too, right? Where that jurisdiction and FDA starts and ends.
Well, again, so like for this We Are Not Waiting movement, which I helped start early on, and now it's like this global thing, like there are Facebook pages that do provide recommendations for apps that are good, secure, safe, etc. And like it's a community developed system. So none of that has anything to do with a device manufacturer, a medical society, or a patient group. So that's all just the crowd. But these are all people that have skin in the game. So frankly, I trust them a lot more than I would an AMA or a device manufacturer.
Let's skip to number two for a second here, just because we're getting closer to time here. So let's talk about number two, we can come back and then talk about this. So a neurologist encourages a concussion patient to use a clinical decision support app at home to measure how differing light levels change pupil size and then transmit the data, et cetera, et cetera. Newly approved standards and meta-tagging definitions allow the doctor to see this data collected in the EHR. The doctor can determine the readings patient generated versus so PGHD versus at a neurologist's office by filtering the meta tags that indicate this pupil size and then using supplemental data to treat the patient's post-concussive symptoms and closely monitor patient's recovery. I mean, that is like Star Trek kind of stuff. It's awesome. Thoughts on number two? Go, Eliel.
I think when I read the two, they are completely different, right?
Yeah.
And so if we're talking about patient access for number two, it's just like a more of interoperability aspect and the fact that there is an app that talks to the EHR. While the first one is more about like who validates that this app is actually doing the work that's supposed to do. So I guess I don't know how much the second one really helps on patient access. It's really maybe validating that there is an app that can communicate with a EHR and a provider and a patient back and forth, but does that increase patient access to information?
Well, the second one for me, and I'm sorry, Hans, you have your hand raised.
Hans, before, then go ahead, Hans.
I'm building a little bit on Elias, and I thought a discussion that we've had around whether the data actually is in the patient's electronic record when it's coming from other apps. When is it? When is it not? Depends on the source. Is it the patient, et cetera, et cetera? Or is it accessible through or next to? And I think to me, the challenging part is that I thought that we had not landed there, and therefore to use it that it's directly in the patient's electronic medical record, and particularly indicating somewhat patient collected data seems to be a little bit of a stretch for the purposes of even the fact that we want to go into an ideal state. But that's purely based on the context that I thought we were still not quite clear altogether on this external data. Where should it actually live? Is it next to, or is it part of?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, both of these, I mean, when I think patient access to information, I don't think getting suggestions for an app that I could use. I think more about, can I get the data that's already been collected about me, generated by me, that's in these systems from my doctors. And the second one, I think, I mean, as somebody who's like advocated a lot for patient-generated health data being incorporated into EHRs, I feel like that the second one really gets more to that issue. And it's cool and great. So, but I'm not sure how that necessarily fits with the target area of patient access to information? Or does it? Is there something that I'm just missing because I've had not enough caffeine or something?
I think what I took away from paragraph number two was that patients' ability to leverage their PGHD in a way for clinical decision making, and for the doctor to trust that data, accurately and rapidly, and make clinical diagnoses based upon PGHD, which we all know today is very hard to do because a lot of them don't talk to the EHR. That's what I walked away with, which is rapid, timely ability to be treated, right? Using a consumer app, air quotes, of some sort that's been vetted.
Which I think is awesome. And it's the thing that I've been advocating about for quite some time. I just don't see how that is patient access to information. That's patients providing access to information.
Okay, that's a good nuance. Interesting. Hans.
My hands should be down. Sorry.
Oh, okay, no problem. LAL.
Yeah, I think that, I don't know if we want to go that route, but I think that's where the two could come together, where what we were saying on the number one was that, somebody needs to be vetting this stuff. And the second one is talking about a specific use case of one of those apps that then has been vetted by FDA, FTC, and reimbursed by CMS, but there could be a possibility of a merger here, but I think that becomes too hard. But I agree with Anna was saying that the second one is not as much as about patient record access, but providing data. Okay. But it doesn't go back to the point that I was trying to make before. It's like somebody needs to validate and certify this stuff. And the second one does that with more specificity. So,
yeah, like a Better Business Bureau kind of thing, right? Definitely. Yeah, coordinating entity for ONC, I mean, they do certification of health IT. I don't think they do certification of consumer apps, but there's got to be a consumer app certification body out there, right? Again, a Better Business Bureau, lack of a better term. But it's not ONC, it's somebody. So I can see how leaving it open-ended with healthcare industry website, going back to number one, or something along those lines, but use whatever words, allows for that to develop at some point in the future. Because it does have to come, it eventually will have to come together logically. Somebody will have to own it. Where that somebody is it the FTC, is it the FDA, who knows? But we'll live somewhere. So are we all leaning towards number one then, with a little bit more veracity on it? Is that what we're leaning towards? Is that what I'm hearing?
I still don't really see how that's patient access to information. I mean, maybe, I suppose it's information.
It's information, right? How do I trust it as a patient, or as a doctor in this case, to give to a patient?
Yeah, I think that the challenge I see here, Anna, is like healthcare data is already complex and voluminous, and just giving patients access to their data doesn't necessarily help anybody because they can be overwhelmed. But if there are then apps that can plot the information in a way that they can understand or organize in some way that makes good use for patients, that is great. But somebody needs to say, yes, this app can be trusted because it's getting the right data. It's sketching it the right way for you to see it. That's why I feel that this one speaks a little bit more in terms of patient access, with the caveat that somebody needs to say, yes, this is good for you to use.
There have been several attempts that I know of in the diabetes space, and I know of a couple that were beyond that, to do this, but they could never keep the funding maintained. And it's just such an incredibly difficult thing because there's so many apps that keep appearing that vetting them all is really challenging. So.
And there's a lot of smoke and mirrors when it comes to apps too, right? It's such a gray market. How do you
know? Yeah, I mean, FDA regulates a tiny, tiny number of them, depending on, FDA only gets involved if they actually make specific treatment recommendations for that individual. Right. So, I have personally been involved with or known of a number of attempts to get something like this started, and it's just not sustainable. So I'm trying to understand what our point is with this.
Hans, your hand's raised.
Yeah, I think for after two, needing to make a choice, that strengthening number one, I think provides a very clear opportunity and tying different systems together in a way that, yes, we still have to figure out and leave it open. Number two, make some assumptions about what the right place is that I think we still have discussed and debated and that need to really still work through what the better way is. So that's why I will be leaning to number one and move that one forward with fleshing that out a little bit further.
Okay. Are we all in agreement that number one is the choice, but we need to just add some more meat to it so it's a little more clear? I think, Anna, you've been alluding to that, which I agree with you.
Yeah, I could track with that one too, if that would be helpful. Since the diabetes app technology world is how I kind of, one of the reasons I got into this space.
I think we're closer to number one than we are to number two right now. And so I think that's.
I mean, it's awesome. Number two is awesome.
Yeah, it is. It's awesome. But I think it's like there's more, right? If we're going to choose, right, I think there's more.
Yeah, what I was going to say there is that even though it's tough and I don't know how it would be done, but I think like has been done, right? Like when I look at Apple and the validation that they do for every app that's trying to go to the Apple App Store as far as security and protecting the privacy of individuals. You know, it's limited to those use aspects, but they have been able to pull it off. And of course, it's a $1 trillion company, but I think that should be a model here where healthcare apps should be validated in some business model of some kind. And I guess that's where CMS comes in.
Something like that, right, exactly. Okay, so then number one, and then you got it, Anna, to add a little bit more meat to it with Michelle, some specificity there. Okay, is there another slide? Excel team, I think this is the last one, right? Yeah, so we can do this for a couple of minutes here, discussion of the background, all right. Obviously, this is the document itself, landscape analysis, et cetera, et cetera. Gap analysis and conclusion appendices. I hope you guys read this. We're not gonna be able to go through the whole thing, but let's just kind of go over it real high level. Next step. Next slide. Or I'm sorry, can you pull up the background research document? Sorry. Michelle, do you want us to go through this document or do you want us just to talk about this?
We don't have to show that one yet. It was more the report itself. We kind of dove right into the stories but didn't talk yet about the rest of that document. And I'll let you know, the supplemental background research document, because of the annual meeting and turnover staff, like we did a quick edit. We're kind of still going back and cleaning a few things up, but you can definitely look at that as well in parallel. But we really want your input on the core document, the report itself.
So given the time constraints, is this something we should do via email or what would you suggest?
Right. So if there's anything urgent people saw now, actually okay. Either document, but especially the main report, you have 10 minutes for that, you know, minus the public comment. But then, yes, traditionally we go back, like people can go in and edit in like the redline tools in the Word document over the next 2 weeks or so, and then get back to ONC by early January. We'll send another email about that. But that's kind of what happens. And then what happens in January is that there's about a week where ONC comes back at a senior level. So the national coordinator and deputy and our division directors take a look, and then it goes back to the co-chairs and then on to the high tech. So it's a real tight timeline in January, but the work group has a couple weeks now. I do apologize that there were the holidays. That's unfortunate, but it's kind of how it's evolved over the last few years. Yeah. We can get this far by mid-January, and then it's kind of on through email and that kind of communication for the next 2 weeks.
Good deal. LL, you have a question.
Yeah, not a question, Aaron, but, you know, based on what Michelle was saying, you know, I start reading and covered quite a bit and couple of things that I thought which aligns with what she was saying was like there were likely some additional updates. Like there's a section talking about the common agreement, TAFCA, and you know, that probably could be updated with the ones that executed and all that. I think that would be a nice addition. And then I think because I didn't get to the end, I noticed like I started making some comments about like there was a section about language access. And I was like, okay, this needs to be a little more emphatic. But then when I get down to the report and I'm like, oh, there's a whole section talking about it, which, you know, invalidated my comment, meaning we probably still need a little more time. There's quite a bit of great stuff in this supplemental document mm-hmm. that I've seen so far.
Yeah, no, totally agree with you. Totally agree. All right, so then our charge then over the next holiday reading, guys, is what you do, right? Where you sip your eggnog and you read the report. Is to get back the feedback to Michelle and the ONC team on those things. I know they do a great job of cataloging your feedback and then responding to it or incorporating it. So they will definitely take a look at that and add in any pieces to it or tweak whatever wording or whatever componentry you come up with. So if that sounds agreeable to everybody, we could take that on for the next couple of weeks and get that back to Michelle. When do you need this back? You said beginning of January, Michelle?
Yeah, it'll be around January 4th or so. So the first week of January.
Okay, let's call it New Year's, by New Year's, right? Let's get it done by New Year's. Just set a date that we all remember, by New Year's. Okay, great.
And you're free to send things earlier if you want to as well.
Yeah, of course. But just, I like throwing dates out there everybody can remember. So New Year's deadline, guys. Try to get your feedback into Michelle by New Year's. Okay, we are at time for public comment then. ONC team, can we please open the line?
Sure. We're going to open up our meeting now for public comments. So if you're on Zoom and you'd like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're on the phone only, go ahead and press *9 to raise your hand. And once called upon, press *6 to mute or unmute your line. So we'll pause for a moment to see if there are any public comments. And at this time, we don't see anybody raising their hand. So I'm going to yield the time back to the work group. Go ahead, Aaron.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all for a great, great discussion today. I think it was fun. I don't know if I can talk about the art of the possible. Great observations. Again, Anna, I appreciate you, your willingness to step up and clean up a little bit of the structure of the stuff to make sure that it really resonates with what the industry has to offer. Eliel, you put your hand up.
Yeah, quick question that to Michelle, you and Aaron. We said January 1st for the supplemental document review and feedback, but is Michelle working on an updated version that will be sent to us and when we expect to see that one to prepare for that?
Good question, Michelle. She may be muted. Michelle, do we have an ETA on when the updated document will be coming out that you mentioned a little bit ago? We'll find out, Eliel. We'll find out.
Great.
Sorry, I'm muted.
Oh, you're muted? Yep. All right, go for it.
Sorry. You do have what you need right now. I didn't plan on another version before January. Probably just version control. It's getting a little out of control here. So okay. Right now you have the latest. The stories might switch out, obviously, but you have those both in slides and another document, which we can resend everything after this meeting. So you have it all together in one packet with the instructions.
Sure.
Awesome. Thank you. That would be awesome. Okay, good. We just make
our comments directly into the Word document and just individually and then send it to you. And then you guys marry all of the comments.
Right.
Okay.
Yep. Okay.
Because I have concurrent review going on at ONC the next 2 weeks as well. That's one reason I don't want to start another new version right now for them to edit. It's already starting to go out the door. So.
Got it. Well, y'all, thank you for a wonderful day of talking through things. And also thank you for a phenomenal year. It has been an honor being co-chair of the report work group, as it was the HITECH itself. You all are excellent, excellent additions to the team. And I have no doubt you will carry forward the torch year over year and really blaze the report to new trails and new heights. I wish you all the best of luck. I will miss you all, but I will see you around. And stay in touch, if you don't mind. I'd love to hear from you. With that,
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron.
Appreciate you around for sure.
Bye, y'all. Bye-bye. Have a good one. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.